We're talking about contact tracing apps and software aimed to help stop the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kemp. Thanks for being here. As cases continue to rise, health departments are ramping up their contact tracing efforts. We've talked about the boots on the ground, this effort to find people who have come in contact with a person infected with COVID-19 and asking them to quarantine. Software companies the world over are pitching in with apps and ways to use smartphone location data. It brings privacy regulations to the forefront. What would you think of a national contact tracing app? Should governments be able to use phone network data to track someone's movements for the sake of stopping the spread? We're at 800-642-1234. Natasha Singer is a technology reporter for The New York Times, where she covers consumer privacy. Natasha, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So you've been reporting on software developed by Google to help people track their exposure to COVID-19, and that some government agencies that use the software were surprised to learn that Google could pick up users' locations. What did you find there?
Well, what we're seeing is all across Europe, countries like Germany and Austria and Ireland and even Latvia are adopting apps that are based on a system by Apple and Google. And it doesn't actually use location to track where you are. It uses wireless Bluetooth low frequency signals that are emitted from people's phones. And it can track people who have a certain app that come into contact with each other for, say, more than 15 minutes, you know, and are really close together. And so it sort of hoovers up all this proximity data. And then if somebody tests positive for the virus, they can send a signal through the app, and it contacts everybody that you came into contact with, again, close contact over 15 minutes or more. And they get an alert saying, somebody, you know, you came into contact with has the coronavirus, and here's what you should do. You should go get a test here, or you should quarantine yourself. And the government's adopted these Apple and Google Bluetooth proximity tracing systems because Apple and Google promised it was privacy preserving. And it is in some respects, right? It doesn't tell the government where you are. It doesn't tell the government who you met. It doesn't collect information about your name. It basically prevents the government from snooping on you. And so millions of people in Europe have downloaded these apps. And it turned out that if you're an iPhone user, it is privacy preserving. But if you use Google's Android phone, right, which is the predominant mobile platform in the world, you have to turn on location services in order to enable this Bluetooth proximity tracing. And there's another setting within that that many people have on and don't know about called location accuracy. And when that's on, it enables Google to use GPS and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and all these other signals to determine your location, and it sends that information to Google. So you have the system that people have promised will preserve your privacy. Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, even gave this huge address encouraging Germans to use this privacy-preserving app. And Chancellor Merkel told Germans no location data will be collected. But the truth is, if you're an Android user and you have this setting on, Google is going to be frequently getting your exact location. And so these apps preserve your privacy from, you know, government snooping, but it doesn't protect users against Google snooping. And there's one piece of news that I didn't report, because after we ran the story about the location data problem with Google, we heard from the professor who's the chairman of computer science at Trinity College in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And he and his colleague had just done some tests, and they found that another service has to be on Android phones to enable the app. And that service actually collects and sends Google your phone number, your Gmail number, the hardware number of your phone, your SIM card serial number, and a whole bunch of other information.
Well, that's the whole nine yards.
Yeah, it's kind of a conundrum here, because governments can rightly claim that these are privacy preserving against government surveillance, but they're not privacy preserving against Google snooping.
All right. So can't Google run a patch? I mean, how can Google shore this up? You'd think that they could fix this.
Well, they say that the apps are privacy preserving, and the system they created with Apple to determine, you know, which phones are near other phones and alert you is privacy preserving. And they claim the rest of it is how Google's Android system works, right? This is how, like, Bluetooth is used to determine, you know, what is near what, right? It's so your headphones can find your laptop, or when you're in the car, you know, your phone can connect to your radio dashboard and you can hands-free talk to somebody in your car, right? But Google points out that there are also ways that Bluetooth can be used to identify your location. So for example, many stores have these physical stationary Bluetooth sniffers. And if you come into a store with your Bluetooth on, the sniffers can determine, oh, this phone is standing by the potato chip aisle. And in fact, this is the same phone that's been coming and standing in front of the potato chip aisle every day for a month. And this other phone belongs to somebody, you know, who constantly is looking at vitamins. And so the stationary Bluetooth sniffers in stores can determine your location just because you're near a stationary thing that knows where it is. And so Google says its Android system requires that location services be on in order for you to use the Bluetooth, because you're basically giving these sniffers permission to find you. It's sort of making you understand that your location could potentially be collected. And Google says that's part of their system. And in fact, it's much more transparent about privacy. So it's really a question of we have two huge companies, Apple and Google, that basically control the phone operating systems in the world, right? 99.9% of smartphones run on either iOS or Google's Android platform. And they are setting the standards for countries to do this digital proximity tracing. And they're the ones with the power, Apple and Google, not these countries. I spoke to regulators in Switzerland and Latvia and other countries, and they were not happy that Google could collect some information from the Android users of their virus tracing apps. Google, one with the power.
We're talking with Natasha Singer. She's technology reporter for The New York Times, where she covers consumer privacy. She's been covering the latest developments on contact tracing apps and their deployment in other countries and the operating of Google and Apple in this environment. You can join in. What do you want to know about how contact tracing apps work? What concerns do you have? Are you concerned about your personal data? And what happens if it's hacked? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Natasha, I want to back up. In 2018 in Europe, there was this law, the General Data Protection Regulation. This was Europe's compliance with data privacy. What have you seen out of that law and the European Data Protection Board?
Well, it's really interesting because in the United States, we don't have a national consumer privacy law, right? We have the Constitution, and it protects us from illegal, warrantless search and surveillance by government, but we don't have anything that generally protects us from snooping by companies. We have kind of sectoral laws, right? We have a health privacy law. We even have a video privacy law, very, very narrow laws. And what Europe has done over the years is put in regulation that protects everybody from snooping from governments, nonprofits, and companies. They don't distinguish. And the rules are basically taken from this principle that privacy and security are fundamental human rights, and that governments or companies that want your information have to ask permission to use it for a very specific and narrow purpose, and they don't have the right to then use it for a secondary purpose. So what we're seeing is that Europe has put in these laws to try to give people more control over where their data goes and have more information about how it's being used.
Pausing there with Natasha Singer, technology reporter at The New York Times. What do you want to know about contact tracing software? Do you think Americans will have to sacrifice some privacy in order to control the spread of COVID-19? Have you looked into apps deployed in Germany, in Ireland, Latvia, elsewhere in the world? How do you think they stack up with protecting private data? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about protecting private data as some countries try out apps to record contacts between people and try to stop the chain reaction of COVID infections. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we learned earlier this spring, Google and Apple said they were jointly developing a COVID-19 tracking system, and it would prohibit the use of location tracking But as our guest Natasha Singer reported last week, devices with Google's Android operating system must turn on location setting for the app to work, and that enables GPS, potentially allowing Google to determine user locations. What do you want to know about Google location accuracy? Have you watched the deployment of contact tracing apps in other countries? What should the U.S. approach be to smartphone data and contact tracing? It's 800-642-1234. And the New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer stays with us. Natasha, we were talking there about the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe. What have these countries where the app has shown these deficiencies, what have these countries said or you know, made amends with?
So it's really interesting because I spent the last couple of weeks, you know, waking up at 5 a.m. to try to track down health regulators in Europe. And in Germany, I called the equivalent of the CDC. And the answer was, well, you know, we tell app users that they have to turn on location services. And we alert them that that means that any other apps on their phone could get their location data. So, you know, our users are informed. And I said, yeah, what about the Google tracking? And they were like, oh, you know, call SAP. They're the technology company that developed the app. And then I called SAP and they said, oh, it's not our problem. It's an operating system problem. You know, call Google. But when I called Switzerland, they said, we think this is a problem. And we have been asking Google for weeks to decouple location services from the app. And then I called Latvia and they said, the equivalent of the Latvian CDC, we do not like that the GPS is on. Right. And so it was really interesting because there's just this bifurcation. They've made sure that the app, the consumer side of these virus tracing apps, is entirely privacy preserving. And they just have no control over the back end Google processing. And they've decided to not talk about it. And they weren't happy that I called.
By and large, though, how have these apps fared in helping to suppress the coronavirus? Are they working?
That is the most important question, and the answer is we don't know yet. The issue is that, first of all, you have to have a country where you have a highly functional medical infrastructure, where there's a huge swath, kind of on a mass scale of population, being constantly tested. Because these apps alert you if you've come into contact with somebody who's tested positive. But if not many people test positive because you don't have enough testing, the apps are not going to work. So that raises a question about whether these kind of apps could work in the U.S. The second thing is many countries in Europe have actually such a low rate of COVID that millions of people are giving up their data and very few people are being contacted. And so we saw in Norway that created its own app that did not use the Google Apple model, that many people signed up for the app and it collected way more information than it needed. It used this Bluetooth system that Apple and Google use. But it also collected location data because the public health authorities wanted to use it to see how many people are meeting people every day, or are they really complying with lockdown, or how far are they traveling every day. So they wanted to kind of hoover up extra data for public health reasons. And the data protection authority in Norway ruled that there were so few cases of coronavirus in Norway, and there was so little evidence that these apps were of, you know, use in stemming the virus, that the risk of collecting all that data and giving it to the government far outweighed any possible health benefit. And the health authority temporarily banned the app. And the health authority told, sorry, the data authority banned the app and told the health agency of Norway that they have to separate the functions of the app and they have to ask users for separate permission. The first permission is for the contact tracing and the second permission is, will you also let us track your location, which has nothing to do with the app, so we can figure out, you know, how, you know, statistics about how people are traveling during COVID, for instance. And so one of the questions that you're asking is, does this work? Well, we don't know because we're too soon into this process. And because in countries where there's so few cases, the apps are not useful. On the other hand, if you think about places like Germany, I think something like 15 million people have downloaded the app. And when I spoke to them a couple of weeks ago, about 500 people had used the system to contact others. And in order to do that, first you go to your doctor, you test positive for coronavirus, and then the doctor offers you a unique authorization code, a kind of token that you can enter into the app. So it's like you are actually confirmed to have a case. You can't say you ever have coronavirus and notify everybody. Mm-hmm. And you take the token and you enter it into the app and it notifies other people. And the question is, you know, what's the effect of 500 people putting a token into their phone and notifying lots of other people, people they might have sat with on a train or a bus for 15 minutes who they didn't know? Did that stop trains of transmission? And chains of transmission? And like, we don't know the answer to that, but is 500 negligible or is that a lot of people? You could argue that if there's a super spreader event and you can prevent that from continuing, that that's actually very, very useful.
We're talking with Natasha Singer, technology reporter for The New York Times, looking at the current technology offerings around the world to help stop the spread of COVID-19 and the potential privacy and digital security implications. With your questions and insights at 800-642-1234. Natasha, how might an app like this work, say, in a college dorm or in a meatpacking plant?
So that is a very timely question, and we're about to find out, because we have companies like Ford that have been trying out technologies like wristbands that have Bluetooth chips on them. And so when workers come into close contact, it vibrates and lets them know they're getting too close together. And we have other companies that are using these wristbands to do contact tracing in this way, to detect who was in contact with whom and alert them when something happens. And in college dorms, the University of Alabama at Birmingham has developed a virus tracing app. And they're going to ask students who come back, and by the way, all the students are going to have a negative COVID test before they can come back to campus at the end of August. It will be voluntary. But you can imagine that, like, if half your dorm is using a virus tracing app on their phone to detect proximity, that there might be kind of, I don't want to call it peer pressure, but some kind of societal trend thing you don't want to be left out from. And if a lot of people on a campus where people live close together are using such an app, and in the case of University of Alabama at Birmingham, where they have their own medical system and they can run 8,000 COVID tests a day, you know, it might actually have a benefit in a localized system where people are really close and the test results can come back really, really quickly, right? Because if I'm wearing this wristband or I'm using an app on my phone that tells me who I come into close contact with, and somebody I was just at a party with and hung out with, you know, and drank beer with for a couple of hours, took a test this morning but doesn't get the results back till next week, he's already infected a lot of people. Right. So it really depends that, you know, the whole medical infrastructure has to be functioning really, really well for these apps to have a value. But they certainly could have a value.
So the U.S. as a whole has not implemented a contact tracing program or any type of accompanying apps. Has President Trump or the administration shown an interest in deploying one in the future?
Well, when Apple and Google announced that they were going to create this technology that governments could use for proximity detection, you know, for this virus tracing, Trump said he was interested and he would look into it. But we are, as you know, a nation of independent states, and we might not want a national government virus tracing app. And so what Google and Apple have done is, you know, whereas in Europe they've said, we're going to give one government agency per country the right to use this technology, they've said in the United States, each state health department may deploy their own version of this. And so we're seeing the state of Alabama, which is at the forefront of this, currently pilot testing versions of an app. And they're going to make it available hopefully in August to everybody in Alabama. And we'll see other states begin to do the same. And the idea is that when enough states have created these apps, and if there's sort of traction with the public, they can make them interoperable. So if you're in Alabama and you need to go to Mississippi or Texas, your app will be able to pick up phones in those states that are using their state's version of this app.
Oh, it's like you're building like a network from the ground up.
Yes. And we're seeing actually Europe, some states in Europe that have these apps are getting together and trying to create interoperability so that if you're in Germany and you use the app and you go to Austria and you're near Austrians who are using the Austrian app, there will also be a network where you could pick up Austrian phones.
You know, if you go to the Apple App Store, you can see contact tracing apps there available for download. Do we have any information or data on how often these apps are being downloaded?
Well, in the U.S., there really aren't very many available. North Dakota did a small project.
Okay.
You can see the European apps. And there's also, you know, these virus tracing apps in Qatar, in India. Many of them you can't download because they're geographically specific.
I see.
Some of them we've tested because people in Europe have sent us their versions. But you can sort of see the descriptions of them. And if you look at some of the European ones, you can also see people complaining about the location privacy issue.
We have the New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer as our guide as we explore how to deploy technology for contact tracing amid the pandemic. What do you think of having an app that communicates with other phones who have the app to notify the user if someone you've come in contact with has the virus? Do you see the value, or does it open the door to data privacy risks and potential abuse? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update with Natasha Singer here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss digital contact tracing applications or apps and potential privacy risks. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Contact tracing is the work to stop the chain reaction spread of COVID-19. The public affairs chief at the National Association of County and City Health Officials told Scientific American last week that our country has no national strategy for contact tracing, and instead the federal government has said to states, do as you wish. Could software platforms help compensate for not having enough human contact tracers? A question we're exploring this hour. Do you work in the health profession? Do you hope technology can help contain the spread? Can it be done without data breaches and personal privacy risks? We're at 800-642-1234. New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer stays with us. Natasha, we were talking in recent weeks with an agency head in the Wisconsin governor's administration, and this person said their afternoon was filled with vendors who were giving presentations to them on technology to help in contact tracing. It seems that, you know, vendors have the ear of local governments, state governments. What is the marketplace like for contact tracing technologies?
Well, it's a free-for-all because every technology purveyor wants to get into the coronavirus surveillance and, you know, prevention market. And so I think it's really important to distinguish between contact tracing, which is a public health practice that's been going on for centuries, right, that we know is proven, in which humans identify humans who've tested positive for a disease that's contagious and ask them a lot of questions and based on the answers determine who they were closest to and who might be the most likely to be infected and then contact those people and then interview those people. It's really important to distinguish between that, which is evidence-based medicine, and apps, which are just going to willy-nilly list everybody you've come into contact with at a certain distance over a period of time and contact all of them. Right. And so there's a risk,
like a scattershot approach.
Right. And there is a risk that, like, then all of those people are going to run to be tested. Right. And could drain resources from the health system. So it's really important not to see the technology as a panacea, but to understand that if you have a very robust contact tracing and testing system with humans, that this could be an added tool that helps maybe notify a few other people. And if there are kind of limits in place and you say to those people, you know, you should social distance, but not everybody needs to be tested. Not everybody you were on the bus with for 15 minutes needs to be tested. I think they could do some good. I think, you know, I spoke to an official of the German health ministry, and he said, like, there are practices we know are proven to reduce the spread of COVID. One is social distancing. Another is wearing a mask, right? We have evidence for this. As far as the digital tools, you're going to be notified after somebody already tested positive. If you have taken precautions like social distancing and wearing a mask, your chances of getting it will be much reduced. But he's like, these apps are not a panacea. They are not a vaccine. And we just have to put them in context. So I think it's really important to put it in context, but also to be optimistic that we might find some technologies that do work. And, you know, go on.
Well, I wonder, too, if someone feels like they download the app on their phone, that they would, it almost would make them feel like they have a little bit more security in knowing exactly what their risk is. And they might then put themselves in more situations where they aren't social distancing.
Well, there is a problem of a false sense of security with these technologies. And another one that many tech companies are marketing, as you talked about with that health official in Wisconsin and all these tech companies were coming to them, which is these temperature scanning screens, right? They're these infrared screens that factories and some schools and restaurants are putting up. And you pause in front of it and it gauges your skin temperature. And then if you have a high fever, you might be sent home. And it gives you the impression that, wow, if I come to work and we have these temperature screeners, I'm really going to be much safer because it's going to screen out people with the virus. And the problem is that it will screen out people who have a temperature, but maybe 40% of people who have coronavirus and are contagious do not have a fever, right? So some people are going to get in to work who are still contagious. And other people, these fever scanning screens are notoriously inaccurate because they're not taking your body temperature like a medical thermometer. They're just taking your skin temperature. So if you've been outside in the cold, or if you've been running and are sweaty, or if you're stressed out, or if you are in menopause, or if you know you're ovulating or whatever, your temperature might be up, right? And so it might say you have a high fever and your boss might send you home, but actually you don't really have a fever and you don't have coronavirus. And so the risk with the technologies is we really want them to work and we're really enthusiastic. And somehow often we think technology works better than humans. And they do have a role and they can be helpful, but they're not going to solve everything. And we have to put them in context. And so the privacy issue is a separate issue. Like if you have a technology that is inaccurate and can give you a false sense of security and violates your privacy, because now your boss is going to get your temperature four times a day and not secure it. It's problematic if the risks are explained to you, and also the fact that, like, this is an additive technology. You know, when I talked to big companies like General Motors, they said, we have social distancing, right? When people come to work, first they have to fill out a questionnaire to say if they have symptoms, to say if they've been near somebody who is actually infected with the virus, right? And then they stand in line and they're given hand sanitizer and they have to put on masks and they have their temperature taken. And then they get into their station in the auto plant and they have this whole new system to wipe down and sanitize the tools. And they're separated as much as they can. And in the lunchroom, maybe there are plexiglass barriers put on the table so they can still sit next to each other and see each other, but they're talking to each other through plexiglass, right? And they're like, we have all these things and we have this temperature screening technology. Right. So if you have this whole multifactorial approach in which technology is one part and can help, that's great. If you think the technology is going to solve this, either miraculously, you know, take the place of thousands of the contact tracers that we need, or take the place of mass or social distancing, it's not. But it can be an additive tool that is helpful in this whole intensive public health package.
We're talking with Natasha Singer, writes about technology for the New York Times. We're exploring the technology offerings on the market or coming to market to help stop the spread of COVID-19 and the potential privacy and digital security risks. Taking your questions as well, what do you want to know about how contact tracing apps work? What concerns do you have? Are you concerned about your data going to places you don't know about? Do you work in the health profession? How do you hope technology can help us get a handle on COVID-19? We're at 800-642-1234. So, Natasha, there's this company that introduced a system called HealthPass for offices. It uses facial recognition to confirm identities and assess their health information before the employees are cleared to enter the workspace. What privacy risks does that present?
Well, you are talking, I think, about Clear, the airport security company. And, you know, Clear gained traction right after 9/11. Because we were freaked out about airport security and we wanted anything possible to screen out terrorists, and Clear set up this system that uses biometric technology, often facial recognition, and you register yourself. You enroll your face. You have to show documentation, you know, like a driver's license. You have to prove you're you. And then when you go to the airport, you can go through a faster lane, right, to have your identity checked because they can verify, you know, your ticket and your face or your it's an iris scan or whatever it is. And so Clear now is morphing from a terrorist security company, a terrorist surveillance company, to a coronavirus surveillance company. And they're offering this new service to companies where they will install an airport-like thing in your office lobby, or it could be at the front of a restaurant or a store. You know, it depends where we're going to go with these tools. And certainly they're going to try it at stadiums, you know, like baseball stadiums. And if you're an employee, you will have to enroll, right? Your company will ask you to enroll your face, and you will be, you know, your identity will be verified through your company. And then you will come to work and you will have filled out a daily symptom checking screener, and they will do a temperature screen and they will verify it's you, and it will be touchless, right? So you won't be touching anything, you know, like swiping a card on a turnstile where your fingers might touch something, right? It will be kind of much more sanitary. And what Clear wants to do is connect that to your medical data. So for example, if you've just been to the doctor and you've had a coronavirus test and you've tested negative, you could connect that to your Clear Pass, and you would get a health pass saying this person is okay to go to work. Or if you took an antibody test, provided that these things become more accurate, you could connect that to your health pass and you could be cleared to come to work. And it's envisioning a future where we likely will have a vaccine, we likely will have better antibody tests, and it's envisioning a future where certain people will be cleared to walk around and other people who maybe haven't had the vaccine may not be able to come to work.
And Clear, so, Clear totally reinvented itself based on these market conditions.
Well, employers are desperate to improve the safety of the workplace, both for workers, because they want workers to know, you know, that their employer is doing the best they can to make the workplace safe, and also for liability reasons, right? Because it's bad for consumers if you have an outbreak at your store or your factory, and it's bad for worker morale and you could get sued, right? So employers are in a tight spot and they want to use all the tools at their disposal to make the workplace safer. And there is a real opportunity for companies like Clear, and there are smaller ones that are using facial recognition coupled with temperature screening in kind of fast food chains like Subway and Pizza Hut to clear people to come into the office. The long-term risk is, you know, that we become a very, very surveillant culture, much more like China, where, you know, your identity will be known and your health status will be known. And it raises questions about fairness as well as privacy. Like if you go into Starbucks, should your barista know if you have had COVID, or should you know if your barista had COVID? It raises questions about, is this kind of surveillance going to fall disproportionately on people of lower income, who are Black, who are Latino, people who are in essential jobs, right, who can't stay home?
We're going to pause there with New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer, who is our guide. We will be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Natasha Singer. She reports on consumer privacy for the New York Times. We've been learning about security flaws that have been found in some contact tracing apps and the complexities of these emerging tech platforms to help stop the spread of COVID. Natasha, looking at our attitudes about privacy and our personal data, and as you have said earlier, how narrow our laws are regarding privacy, do you suspect attitudes here in the U.S. about privacy will change as we become more desperate to control the coronavirus?
You know, I think many people want to do their part for public health. And if there were an app available that was proven to slow the spread of coronavirus or accurately tell people that they had been exposed and they should get tested, I think a lot of people would want to participate. I would want to participate. But I also think we have to weigh the enthusiasm against the information that these things actually help. And so, for example, if we look at Australia, government officials were introducing a virus tracing app that notifies people if they've been in contact with somebody who tested positive for the virus. And government leaders said to Australians, you know how you have to wear sunscreen before you go outside? And it's sort of a national mantra to reduce the risk of skin cancer because they've had epidemics. You must put this app on your phone and turn it on before you go outside, right? And so the marketing was, this is going to save your life, just like skin cancer protection with sunscreen, right? And the thing is, 6 million people in Australia downloaded this app. And last time I checked, not one person had been contacted by contact tracing authorities through the app that had not already been contacted by humans, right? So you have 6 million people giving up their data and agreeing to use this tracking app, and there wasn't any benefit yet. And so would you want to give up your privacy to try to help stem the spread of coronavirus for something that hasn't helped anybody? Right. And so I think it's really worth asking the efficacy questions, and it's always worth asking, what do we know works? And should we encourage more people to do what we know works, like wearing a mask, or use unproven technology that we hope does something that's really shiny and really hopeful, but we don't have any evidence yet?
It's hard, though, because we put so much stock into technology, in figurative sense, that we really think technology can help save the day and could possibly help save, stop the spread of the pandemic. So where do you strike a balance between privacy and allowing technology to do what it does so well and do its job right?
I think we want technology that works. And I think that we're in a situation, which is an emergency, where we want to roll out technology much more quickly. And that's completely understandable. But if we look at what happened with the FDA, right, they approved all kinds of tests. And then they had to walk some back because they were highly inaccurate. And the danger of giving people inaccurate test results, oh, you don't have coronavirus, you can go outside. And then they infect more people. So I think we have to find a balance between the rush for innovation and the need for some kind of efficacy evidence.
As you look at that balance, where do you watch next? You're looking at governments all over the world, and including here in the U.S., how we go about contact tracing and how we use our technology. What are you watching for?
You know, I'm really fascinated by what's happening in Alabama, that the University of Alabama at Birmingham, as we talked about, developed its own apps to help, you know, students who are coming back reduce the risk of getting the coronavirus. But in parallel with that, right, they have their own health system. They can test 8,000 people a day for coronavirus, and they're going to help organize the state to test 250,000 college and university students before they come back to work. So it's the coupling. It's the coupling of the technology with what we know works in medicine by an institution that has a huge medical school and expertise. So I think when you have technology companies that are really enthusiastic but completely divorced from the health system, it's different than when you have technology companies that are either health tech companies or that are partnered with health experts to try to make things work to fit the system we have. And I'm really enthusiastic and encouraged by the health experts getting together with the tech experts.
I wonder if the UAB model may spread to other universities.
Well, when I spoke to them, they said that their health check app that they're using for students, that other universities around the state want to use it, and that they've been approached by universities outside of the state. And so you can see that, like, it's not just that UAB has health expertise. They're an educational institution trying to develop things that will work for their students, for their system, for other universities, and for their entire state. And so I think on the one hand, we have these tech giants rushing in, like Apple and Google. And it's really important because of their reach, right? If their system works and they have access to 99.9% of the phones in the world, and they can change their operating systems to help prevent the spread of COVID, you know, they have a bigger scale than governments. We want them to come in with something useful. Well, but we also want to be evidence-based.
Natasha, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
Natasha Singer is a technology reporter for The New York Times, where she covers consumer privacy. farmers have traditionally been seen as a core Republican constituency, but Wisconsin Democrats are making a play for the ag community ahead of this year's presidential election. Hope Kerwin has more on the pitch from both parties and whether farmers are willing to listen.
Vice President Mike Pence has made a handful of visits to Wisconsin this year. His last one was to a dairy farm just north of La Crosse. Pence sat down with local farmers and a state legislator to make his case for how the Trump administration has helped farmers. He pointed to the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which officially replaced NAFTA earlier this month.
USMCA is a win for American workers. It's a win for American farmers. It's a win for American dairy. And it's just one more example of how President Donald Trump puts America first and always will.
Rural communities, especially in western Wisconsin, helped Trump win the state and ultimately the presidency in 2016. And heading into this year's election, the Trump campaign is hoping to secure their votes again. The pitch works for some dairy farmers, like Amy Penterman, who owns Dutch Dairy in Thorpe and sits on the board of the Dairy Business Association. She won't say who she's voting for, but she likes Trump's approach.
You know, we really appreciate the fact that he's working to get trade deals done in other countries that are fair and really focusing on those deals to get them done.
But Trump's trade policy has turned off other dairy farmers who question whether the president has hurt agricultural exports more than he's helped, especially after retaliatory tariffs traded with countries like China and Mexico largely targeted U.S. farm goods. Mitch Breinig owns Mystic Valley Dairy near Sauk City.
When we kind of do these hardline negative negotiations, you know, I think it's just hard to go back and say, yeah, we're going to do business with you because we like to do business with you. You know, those relationships are built over time.
Breinig voted for Trump in 2016, but says he's undecided this year. He feels like the Trump administration isn't aware of the economic situation that farmers are facing. He points to a comment made by Trump during a campaign rally last October, saying farmers would have to buy bigger tractors to meet the new demand from an initial trade deal with China.
They don't really understand my business. They don't understand it at all.
This frustration is what Democrats are hoping to capitalize on as they make a play for the ag community. Earlier this year, Governor Tony Evers called a special legislative session focused on helping struggling dairy farmers. And during a virtual campaign event this summer, presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden said the high number of farm bankruptcies in Wisconsin could be linked to the Trump administration's trade strategy.
How many farmers would be in a better spot if their profits hadn't vanished because Trump goaded our trade partners into placing brutal tariffs on American cheese?
The question, in a year when COVID-19 has captured the public's attention, is whether Wisconsin dairy farmers will hear that message. Anthony Trigoski is a political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He says that given the limited time left before the election, the easiest path for Democrats to win Wisconsin is not through rural communities, but continuing to win over suburban areas.
How much do they focus their pitch on these affluent, educated suburbs where they've seen real growth potential versus how much do they focus on rural communities and agriculture communities where Trump and the Republicans have really solidified their standing?
But Trigoski says it could be a mistake for Democrats to ignore rural Wisconsin. He says that would only deepen the divide between urban and rural communities that was so apparent after the 2016 election. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.